From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a water crisis for Bay City.
Once we know where it's going to, we can figure out where the break is, and then we can make corrections. So that's where we are right now.
Plus, what is innovation, and can you learn to be innovative?
The idea about some genius sitting in an attic inventing new stuff is pretty much a myth. Innovation is a team sport. It takes ideas and skills all put together in order to make something happen.
And the sadly overlooked life of Michigan Governor Lewis Cass.
He was governor for 18 years. He set down the laws in something called the Cass Code. He established Michigan Avenue, the road to Chicago.
Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. In Michigan, we see great ideas all around us. For instance, Cass Community Social Services in Detroit. They've launched a project called Detroit Treads. They're taking old tires and turning them into sandals. But how do you make a great idea a reality? I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we find out just what innovation is and whether you can actually learn to be innovative. And when you visit one of Michigan's beautiful beaches, you ever wonder what's below the surface? Later this hour, we hear how a fish native to the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea made it into all five of the Great Lakes. But first, quite a few stories buzzing around Lansing late last week. Here to fill us in on all the action is our hosting team for It's Just Politics, Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. Hey, you two.
Hey, Cindy.
Hello.
So let's start with last Friday's resignation of the head of the state's Housing Development Authority. We actually talked with him here on Stateside, Scott Woosley, accused of wasting public funds on lavish travel expenses. Fill us in, Zoe.
Yeah, so $200,000, more than $200,000 in travel expenses. These included things like a stretch limo in Nebraska, high-priced hotels, dinners, which were basically just three glasses of vintage rum. I mean, you know, when you kind of make jokes and you say, gosh, what would look really, really bad in expense accounts? This is what you picture.
Particularly when you're the head of the Housing Development Authority for a struggling state.
Exactly. And of course, I mean, that's exactly the headlines that we're hearing as, you know, middle class folks are being this. And as these departments are being cut, you know, the politicians living the high life. Well, you know what? Here, that is what was happening.
And Rick, this was a pretty quick resignation in terms of when the story broke and when Scott Woosley announced he was stepping down. And didn't he first say, no, I'm not going to step down because I figured, well, the state would just not reimburse me for things that aren't supposed to be covered, like three glasses of vintage rum?
He said, I turn in my expenses and then the state decides whether or not the expenses are appropriate, which, I mean, in some respects is what a lot of people do who have those kinds of jobs, is that you turn them in, someone inspects them and says, you know what, this one isn't actually according to Hoyle. But the optics were really bad on this,
right?
That there may be more to learn about this, but the optics was really bad. And it was clear that the Snyder administration was not going to allow this to linger, especially with the November elections, you know, now drawing near. We're past the primaries. People are going to start paying a little bit more attention. And so it was decided that Scott Woosley needed to, you know, quickly and as quietly as possible go away. So he said that, you know, this had become a distraction and it was time for him to move on to make sure that the agency could focus on the work that it, you know, that it had to do.
In the meantime, if you're a Democrat, this is a grand club with which to thump Snyder Republicans, isn't it? What have the Dems been saying as they talk this up?
Well, I think one of the reasons why Scott Woosley moved along so quickly was that, you know, fair or unfair, there's this pattern developing of, you know, people either in the administration or just connected to the administration, you know, having issues like this, that John Covington left the Educational Achievement Authority. He was the director, you know, after an expenses scandal.
Right.
And then you'll remember Andy Dillon, the state treasurer, who was continuing to collect his severance salary while he was off on a cruise. And so, you know, there's just this collection of just bad looking things. happening at a time when you really don't want them to happen.
And Cindy, that's exactly right. As you said, I mean, there is this narrative that Democrats are going to use. We also had some folks
are already using.
Already will continue to use. And as you said, in an election year, when the governor is up for reelection, we'll remember there were some issues with some of his top administration officials when Governor Snyder first took office, making $250,000. Meanwhile, cuts to certain departments. So this is a narrative that Democrats will use. Mm-hmm. Truthfully, I think as much as Democrats are saying it's a good thing Woosley is going, they're probably pretty bummed that they didn't get to stretch this out into another week. So
you know what?
I think they'll
find plenty of ways to continue to use this.
Well, no, they're saying, I mean, that even more shoes might drop. But we did see this resignation happen on a Friday, which, of course, is always interesting, try to kind of bury it over the weekend. But no, I mean, I think the swiftness at which this resignation came is absolutely an indication of new things to see in the way that things are being handled, possibly, in the administration.
And, you know, we sort of saw all of this happening late Friday. Sometimes it's in our business, we call it the news dump.
The news dump.
That it happens late on a Friday when people are already moving on to the weekend, so that we had the news about Scott Woosley resigning. We also heard that the state was going to continue to pay a private contractor to do prison food services, you know, despite some scandals, including, you know, some raucous and inappropriate behavior between inmates and employees of the Aramark Corporation and the Snyder administration, instead of terminating the contract, as was almost universally expected. The administration fined Aramark $200,000 and said, and named sort of an independent overseer, and said that we're going to give them one more chance. So, you know,
we've talked about this Aramark issue on the program, but let's just kind of revisit this, because this is really quite the story. We're talking big issues, aren't we, Zoe?
Big issues. I mean, at issue really is this basic idea of whether prison food services should have been privatized or not. At least that's what folks who don't believe that the business should have been privatized are saying this is all about. And what we've seen over the past couple months is we've been talking a lot about stateside maggots in food, sexual relationships, inappropriate, obviously, sexual relationships.
Well, we don't know how far that went, but I mean, there was definitely physical contact, dancing. There was even a party with someone doing cartwheels at the Ionia facility,
and we know there was some action in a food cooler,
right?
Yeah.
Two.
Yes, yeah. I think four people total. We're still trying to figure out the math on that one.
Perhaps not all at the same time.
But we're not sure.
This contract has been just problematic from the get go. In part because even the professionals within the corrections department weren't really hot on the idea of a private service coming in and taking care of doing, you know, food service, which is one of the most sensitive points in a prison. Because if you think about it, I mean, there's all kinds of room for things to go wrong. Inmates are moving around, that there are only a certain number of things that really matter, you know, inside a prison. And food is certainly one of them. And you want to keep that line moving, you want to keep the inmates happy and not, you know, complaining about unexpected changes in the service. And let's not forget that there are also sharp objects there. So just a lot of room for things to go wrong. And the administration handed this over to a private company.
And you want them to be healthy. And we did have reports of inmates becoming ill.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And we don't know that, in fairness, we don't know that was actually caused by Aramark, that it is possible that they were just two concurrent events that may or may not have been related.
And again, I mean, this goes back to the narrative, though. I mean, we don't know that maybe Scott Woosley, the head of MSHDA, did usually have three glasses of vintage rum for his dinner. I mean, whether or not that's the case. But these are the problems, right? This is what it looks like to people. And what it looked like is this private company was not doing well. And so, like this resignation happened, Friday afternoon, we hear that, in fact, they are going to keep this contract, $145 million. Over 3 years contract, but be fined $200,000.
And I got to wonder, I've got to ask it out loud. It's kind of hard to imagine $200,000 knuckle wrap, I think people are calling it that, or will really end some of these issues.
That, Cindy, and I mean, exactly, that Aramark is saying things like, well, the potatoes we got that had maggots in it, well, that came from the potato distributor.
Right.
So, and then yet they're saying, no, we can stop this. So it's this sort of sticky.
They've taken action on the the distributor as well, because the thing is, the potatoes never made it into Aramark's bailiwick,
so
that it was stopped at the door.
There's a lot of, well, it was our fault, this wasn't, we can take an issue of these things. I don't think anyone, I mean, Rick, would you be surprised if there was another Aramark issue? I mean, we've already seen, I think, almost 80 Aramark employees already be fired or mm-hmm. suspended or something mm-hmm. like that because of, I mean, 80 just in Michigan. So it's hard
since
for me
December.
To believe. Right. It's hard for me to believe that we are not going to see
It certainly has people wondering why we're continuing down this road and not either, you know, returning to the system that we had or you know, putting it out to bid. But, you know, between Scott Woosley, between, mm-hmm. Aramark and the fact that that's not going to be prolonged, that mm-hmm. last week was not a good week for relentless positive action.
No, but I think you are getting this idea, though, that is this somewhat of the beginning of real campaign season, that now that the primaries are over after last mm-hmm. Tuesday, that folks want to wipe their hand clean if there is a scandal, rather than let it, you know, seep forward a little like happened with Andy Dillon, as we were talking about earlier, Chancellor Covington, as some of the issues with John Nixon, with this furniture company, with the Nerd Fund, some of those things that dragged and that Democrats could keep talking about. Mm-hmm. And not that Democrats won't keep talking about this, but you are getting a sense that is the Snyder administration now jumping forward when there are issues and taking care of it right away rather than letting it leak anymore.
Reviewing a very, very busy week with some very interesting news headlines from Lansing. Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, our It's Just Politics intrepid team. As always, thank you so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
My pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We recently came across an intriguing story about the Cass Community Services in Detroit. They've come up with a design to repurpose old tires and turn them into sandals and mud mats. Well, here is something truly innovative. The city gets rid of some illegally dumped tires, and folks who need a job can get one. They have 80 people working on the mats and sandals, and they plan to add another 20. That got us wondering, where does innovation come from? Just what is it, and can you teach it? Richard Price is the Stanley C. Shore Collegiate Professor of Psychology and Organizational Studies at the University of Michigan. He's here now. Thanks so much for being with us today, Richard.
Delighted, Cynthia.
You actually taught a class called The Psychology of Innovation, Creating a New Enterprise. And I'm wondering, how would you grade this sandals from old tires idea by the Cass Community Services? What's innovative to you about it?
Well, there's lots of innovative, and in fact, you described lots of it, Cynthia. The idea that people had an itch to make something better, that they clearly talked with each other and began to have a vision about what it might look like, and that clearly they had raw materials at their disposal, some sense of what might be possible, and some experience. Obviously, some people had to know where the outlets needed to be for products like this, what the need might be, what the market is, how to fashion it, and so on. So those are some of the personal ingredients, but there's more to it, actually, we found in teaching the course and in our own research. There are at least two other things that are important. One is, I think, the recognition, and your example is a really good one, the recognition that innovation happens between people, not alone. The idea about some genius sitting in an attic inventing new stuff is pretty much a myth. Innovation is a team sport. It takes ideas and skills all put together in order to make something happen. And your sandals example is a really nice idea, a nice example of it.
How do you define innovation, Richard?
Innovation is anything that changes the status quo in ways that improves it from the point of view of some potential user. That covers a lot of ground, and it's intended to, because I think we often think about innovation. We also often confuse innovation and invention. Invention is an idea. Innovation is making it real. And entrepreneurship is the business by which you take a new idea and find a market for it and turn it into an enterprise. So there are three quite different things.
So we see someone like Steve Jobs, and you just go from A to B to C.
If you read carefully about Steve Jobs, one of the things you'll discover is most of the things that he brought to life were somebody else's idea. The mouse is a good example. It was sitting in Xerox Corporation on a shelf until he came along, saw what use it might be made of it, and then found it, built a team in order to actually take it from a big clunky box into the thing we use today.
I'm talking about innovation with Richard Price, who is a professor of psychology and organizational studies at the University of Michigan. Can you teach innovation, Richard, or does someone have to just be born that way?
Great question. You certainly can teach it. I wouldn't have been teaching a course on it unless I believed that you could teach it, but you have to teach it a certain way. I call it action learning. That is, you can't just learn it out of a book, although examples and conceptual frameworks that help you think about it are really important. But you also have to roll up your sleeves and do it and learn from your own experience. That's what action learning is all about. So in this course that we did, we started with very basic ideas generated by the students and helped them take them to the level at which they were actually a prototype that they could pitch to other people. So in the course of that project, everybody developed their own ideas. They created teams, chose the best ideas that were most appealing to them, and then went out into the world to interview people who were experts in the particular domain where they thought an idea would be a good one. And when they did, I asked them to revise their idea every week and gave them feedback on it. And then finally, after weeks of agony and excitement, they were able to pitch their idea to the whole class. And it turned out to be pretty exciting because a number of them actually came to pass.
Huh. So give us an example. For instance, what kind of...
Well, one of the things that I especially... Well, I'll give you a few examples. One team created a health food truck and started that enterprise. Another designed a project for teaching inner-city kids how to apply to college because they realized that lots of inner-city kids didn't have experience with it, and maybe their parents didn't either, but that they had a skill that they could turn into a program to teach kids how they might go about it. Another interesting one that happened right here at Michigan was that one of our teams actually realized there were so many entrepreneurs out there among the students that they decided they needed a marketplace where these entrepreneurs could actually display their wares and interest other people in them. So they created a marketplace that ended up in the basement of the union where people could come in, talk to the innovators, see how their ideas worked, give them feedback, even think about investing in it.
We've heard this from our governor, that this is the kind of mindset and the kind of skill set that Michigan needs to help in its recovery, and this seems to spell it all out perfectly.
You bet. And I think the big myth that you really have to bust is that there are only a few people that are entrepreneurs, actually, and a few people are innovators. Actually, in our daily lives, we innovate all the time. And you don't have to be a super expert or a super scientist. For example, if you have a workplace, and you do, Cynthia, you look around, you may see some things that could use some improvement. And in fact, if you're the kind of person who wants to take that idea forward, you could probably create an innovation in your own station that might make things work better for not only yourself but other people.
I guarantee you moms and dads are doing that on the home front every day, aren't they?
They are indeed.
What would you say, Richard, is the biggest challenge in getting over that hump of identifying a problem to actually developing that creative solution?
Well, I think one of the things is that every day, each of us comes up with lots of new ideas that we don't pursue. And every once in a while, we come up with an idea that we get excited enough that we want to pursue it, but we get discouraged right away when we hit a barrier, and we drop it. And ideas operate along an evolutionary path. Many, many, many are created, and only a few survive. One of the great mysteries is, why do they survive, and which ones survive? And one answer to that is, at least at the level of individuals who are trying to create something new in the world, is that they think that failure is a problem. But actually, you can't learn anything in this world unless you fail. So a crucial thing to understand is that when something doesn't work, then you've just suddenly learned something. When you learn something, you're ready to pick up the pieces again and get back to work. So failure is something in our culture that is stigmatized. Everybody thinks it's a bad thing. It's embarrassing. We try to hide it. But the truth of the matter is failure is what we need to be able to do if we're going to keep moving forward.
Very wise words from Richard Price, who is the Stanley C. Shore Collegiate Professor of Psychology and Organizational Studies at the University of Michigan, as we explore innovators. Thank you so much, Richard. have Cass County, Cass City, Cassopolis, Cass Tech High School in Detroit, Cass Lake, and many other cities, townships, and streets, not only in Michigan but around the country, all named after Lewis Cass. He was a towering figure in Michigan and indeed the United States in the 19th century. So why is it we don't know very much about Lewis Cass? Historian Bill Loomis is here to set us straight. Bill, we know the name. Why don't we know the man and what he did?
You know, that's a good question. That's something that I was interested in myself. But there's a few reasons that historians have given as to why he's kind of gone by the wayside. I would say most importantly is he was a moderate person prior to the Civil War. His writing was not as fiery as a lot of other people, so he isn't quoted very often. I found only one quote attributed to Lewis Cass online. He was also temperate. He didn't drink, and so he wasn't a real sociable type of person or as sociable as others. But mostly, like I said, he was a moderate. He was in the middle. He saw himself as a national person, so he was always seeking support of the South and the North, which put him in kind of an empty spot in between.
Because there was not a lot of in between in that time leading up to the Civil War. You were either really anti-slavery or you wanted to preserve slavery.
Exactly.
But the contributions this man made are stunning when you run through them. Let's first talk about what Lewis Cass did for Michigan.
He was appointed by Madison as governor of Michigan in about 1814. It was in terrible shape after the War of 1812. People literally were starving. It was a lot of Indian, Native American attacks on farmers and things like that. So he had his hands full. In fact, he didn't even bring his family to Detroit for several years until he got things straight. It was a very terrible time.
Wow. So governor for 18 years.
That's right. He was governor for 18 years. He explored the North and became an expert on North American Indians in what was then the Northwest Territory. Mm-hmm. He was also he set down the laws in something called the Cass Code. He was very keen on having roads because during the War of 1812, one of the problems was there were no roads and they couldn't get supplies. So he established, say, like Michigan Avenue, the road to Chicago, if you will. He was just an all-around – he also had the biggest personal library. He was a scholar of sorts and had a formal education. So he had the biggest Michigan library at that time.
He also wrote our state motto, you tell us.
That's right. He wrote the state motto and designed the state seal.
But – and then – as if that's not enough, what he did for the United States, his list of accomplishments and titles is mind-boggling.
Yeah, he served under, I think, five presidents. First assignment was from Thomas Jefferson in Ohio, and he went all the way through James Buchanan right before the Civil War. So he started – his real contributions began with Andrew Jackson as Secretary of War.
Secretary of War, Secretary of State, U.S. Senator, Brigadier General, Minister to France, Head of Indian Affairs, a friend to the King of France, and a presidential candidate.
Yeah, that's right. 1848, he lost to Zachary Taylor.
Why? But,
well, he was in between again. Yeah. It was this uncertainty. There were also three candidates. Martin Van Buren also ran as a Free Soil candidate, which sort of split the Democratic vote up. But he was, again, not a very good campaigner. He was kind of dull and didn't have the – Zachary Taylor at the time was a bit of a war hero from the Mexican-American War.
That's right. So that helped much the way we saw Eisenhower elected after World War II.
Exactly.
The tide of popular opinion and gratitude.
That's right.
So when you talk about Indian affairs, because that was part of what he was involved with, what positions did he take on that? Because my understanding from what you wrote is, was he actually part of the Trail of Tears?
Yeah, he kind of was. But – as he saw it, his experience with Indians in the Northwest Territory was they were damaged in their relationship with white settlers.
Okay.
They were taken advantage of. Land was stolen from them. They suffered from terrible, terrible alcoholism, poverty. They were just victimized. And Georgia was growing. People were settling in there at a huge rate. In fact, the whole East was being settled, and they were just being pushed out. So as he saw it, it was not a great choice, but he saw it as the only hope for a lot of those tribes was to have them out west where they would not be near white people and be pushed and be pushed to despair. He also, though, felt that he was what they called a spread eagle expansionist. He believed in complete expansion, physical, geographic expansion of the U.S. So he saw this as a manifest destiny. This was America's purpose.
And it was that mindset that led to incredibly horrific conditions for the native tribes.
Yes.
All the way through, across from the Atlantic to the Pacific.
Yeah, but he did guarantee – well, I mean, it was a terrible thing. There's no there's no getting around it.
Yeah.
Cass did guarantee them safe passage. They had to walk, so people died of exposure and exhaustion. But he would not allow people to take advantage of them as they walked. He wouldn't allow them. He gave them protection as they went out west. He did a little better than some of that time. It was he was a man of his time.
A man of his time. And, and we're looking at him now with the hindsight from 2014. His positions on slavery, you write that he would actually weep when he thought about the United States breaking apart.
Yeah, his position on slavery was, again, like you say, he was a man of his time. But he was what was called a doughface. He was one of the a northerner with sympathies for the South. He didn't approve slavery, but he said it's there. We have to deal with it. He said this generation didn't start the slavery, so we have to treat it, you know. He did not like the abolitionists. On the other hand, he did not like the radical Southerners as well. So he was really trying to make both parties come together, and it just wasn't working.
And then you write that really his nightmare became the formation of the Republican Party, which you remind us happened in Jackson, Michigan.
That's right. That's right.
So that was what went into that? You had a meeting of, what, former Democrats, Whigs, and Free Soilers?
That's right. All the people that – the Whigs had basically disbanded. Mm. They were no longer around. And so they were looking for some place to go. A lot of his friends actually who were Democrats – went over to the Republican Party. And then the Free Soilers, of course, that was another party that was comprised of people who believed the new territories were to be free. So the Republicans were one step closer to the abolition of slavery.
And he
completely.
Wanted to let the territories decide as they entered, right? He was
That was something that he really took credit for, although other people had talked about it. But the idea of popular sovereignty, where the territory, let's say Kansas, Missouri, would decide themselves. The problem was people twisted it and started sending abolitionists, started sending in people by the hundreds, armed with guns. The Southerners came up, the same thing. They just contorted it until finally it was just a bloodbath and a kind of a precursor of the Civil War, really.
How was Lewis Cass then regarded during all of this? Was he demonized? Was he ignored?
Right. Up until, say, the mid-1840s, he was okay. But as it got closer in time, and I mean, people were pulling guns on each other on the floor of the Senate. So in that atmosphere, he was definitely demonized. He was, like I said, seen as a doughface. Walt Whitman wrote sarcastic poetry about him.
Whitman is throwing shade at you, that's not good.
I know. And up until then, Cass had been seen as sort of a modest kind of middle-of-the-road person, products of moderation. So when the 1850s hit, then feelings were just too distant. Nobody would come and sit at the table to work these things out. They really didn't want to.
So as the nation endured the Civil War, was he part of it? Was he on the sidelines back here in Michigan? And what happened for him after the war?
Well, he resigned under James Buchanan's presidency because Buchanan hesitated or refused to support the military, the U.S. military in South Carolina. Once he did that, then suddenly the northern viewpoint was very sympathetic for him and saw him as really not a bad person any longer. So he spent the Civil War in Detroit. He was quite old then. He was in his 80s. And he died actually a year after the surrender of the South occurred. But he retired and lived with his daughter. And they would go to Mackinac Island and relax and things like that. So he was in Detroit.
So it certainly seems that Lewis Cass deserves to be a little better remembered than he is.
I think so.
Bill Loomis, his story on Lewis Cass, the titan of Michigan's early years. You can find it on the Detroit News Michigan History blog site. Bill, thanks so much.
Oh, you bet, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Bay City residents are being asked to conserve water, and a handful of businesses are even being told to stop using city water altogether. This comes after city officials discovered a major drop in water reserves over the weekend. But they have yet to find the more than 10 million gallons of water that has leaked from the system. Richard Finn is Bay City's city manager.
Once we know where it's going to, we can figure out where the break is, and then we can make corrections. So that's where we are right now.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody has been following this story. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Welcome from a very rainy and a very wet Bay City.
Well, city officials certainly have this mystery on their hands. They found out Saturday water was missing. What alerted them to that?
Well, they saw that there was the reserve amount of water they have in their system was going down, and they couldn't figure out what the problem was. And they saw there was about a 5 million gallon loss about every 12 hours, and they had been trying to find that leak ever since.
What a mystery. And here they're searching for the source. And it just is a little hard to imagine not being able to find the leak that's letting some 10 million gallons of water drain out.
Yeah, you would think, especially as dry a weekend as we had, that it would have been relatively easy to spot 10 million gallons of water just kind of lying around somewhere. They did think for a while that it might have been one of the water mains that crosses beneath the Saginaw River. But they've tested those, and at this point, it does not appear that that's the source of the leak. So they have been out searching and trying to find where they could find a large body of standing water, which, again, this weekend might have been easier, but as of right now, we are getting a very heavy rainstorm, so that might complicate things if they haven't found the leak yet.
And we know that they do have water in reserve, but there's some concern that might run out, what, even as early as today?
Well, the thing is, at this point, they have about as much water coming into the system as normally goes out during a conservation period like they have right now. As long as people just use water for bathing and for cooking and for personal hygiene, and businesses refrain from using a lot of water, they should have enough to get through. But then again, if people start using more water for, you know, like watering their lawns or doing laundry, that could present a problem, because then they would have more water leaving the system than they currently have coming in. And with the reserves way down, you know, things could get a little dicey later this week.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody reporting on the water crisis in Bay City. Steve, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
When you stand on the shore and look out over any of the Great Lakes, ever ask yourself, wonder what's below the surface? What might you encounter as you swim, scuba dive, or fish? Well, there's no better person to shine a light on just what's in the Great Lakes than David Jude. He's a research scientist emeritus at the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan. Dave, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Overall, which of the Great Lakes is the most populated and the least populated?
Oh, the least populated, of course, is Lake Superior. And we see that reflected in the kinds of changes that have gone on. And probably the most affected would be Lake Erie and Lake Ontario, because that's sort of the route where the Europeans came in. And so that's where the most people populated that area. And that's where the most damage and also effects have occurred as well.
What about as far as underwater life population?
Well, that's a big question. it depends upon what lake you talk about. And again, we made the distinction between Superior and Erie. And Erie is by far has the most species of fish and is also the most productive. It's said that the other four lakes equal the catch that you would get from Lake Erie. And, of course, Lake Erie is shallow. And it also has an interesting characteristic in that it's got three different basins, the shallow western basin and the central basin and then the eastern basin. And as a result of that, you've got a high diversity of habitat. You've got rivers, you've got bays, you've got a lot of aquatic plants, you've got reefs, and diversity of habitat begets diversity in fish populations as well. So that has the highest diversity of fish in Lake Erie. And then the least is Lake Superior, because it's so cold and so deep.
So you have to be a very hardy fish.
Yes,
to make
and evolve for that sort of habitat. Right.
Well, if you can, I'd like to have you take us on an underwater tour of the Great Lakes. Let's say I am swimming. I'll start in Lake Erie, and a fish swims by. What type would it most likely be?
Wow. I would have to draw on my experience at South Bass Island. I spent a lot of time there. And we used to seine regularly a place called Alligator Bar. And it's a little rocky reef that runs out from the shoreline. And if you were wading around in that area, the most probably abundant fish that you'd see right now are round gobies. And I don't know if you're familiar with those or not, but they're an exotic species from Russia that came in 1990.
Oh, so they're invasive.
Yes, invasive species. And I happened to be the first one to collect them back in 1990. I was doing a study on the St. Clair River. And I picked up this fish and I said, well, I haven't seen a fish like this before. And I took it over to the museum and showed it to Jerry Smith. And he said, it's a goby. Where did you get that? And the family gobiidae is not present in North America, needless to say, the Great Lakes either. So it was a big surprise to him. And so since then, they've proliferated and they're found in all five of the Great Lakes right now. So
how'd they get here?
Ballast water ships. You know,
hitching a ride.
Nemesis of ballast water ships, yes. And so they would make up about 60% of the catch. So probably 60% of the fish you would run into if you were on alligator bar swimming there would be around gobies. It's a nice vegetated area. So there's a lot of aquatic plants there too. So probably you'd see yellow perch, which people all have heard about. And there's a lot of gizzard shad. And you would probably see brook silversides and a lot of bass. There's two different species of bass, the largemouth bass and the smallmouth bass there. So you'd see a lot of those. And usually in these nearshore zones, they're small fish. They're usually young of the year fish. A lot of those are present. So depending upon, you know, whether there was a good hatch or not, you might see a few alewives swimming around as well. So that's what you would encounter if you were in Lake Erie.
Let's head up to Lake Huron.
Well, Lake Huron, of course, is less productive than Lake Erie, and I haven't had a lot of experience in Lake Huron, but I would expect a lot fewer species of fish. Probably, if you were out in the water, you would run into spot-tailed shiners, which is one of the common shiners that's on the bottom. And recently, what has happened in Lake Huron, and it's a dramatic change that's gone on there, is that with the introduction of the quagga mussels, we've had what we call a trophic cascade going on there. And the quagga and the zebra mussels, when they came in, filter the water of the algae. They remove algae from the water. And so if you look at chlorophyll A, which is an indication of the amount of algae in the water, the chlorophyll A in Lake Huron is less than in Lake Superior. So Lake Huron is essentially turning into Lake Superior. So it's very what we call ligotrophic, very low in nutrients right now. And as a result of that, this is a kind of a long story to get to my point, but the result of that is the alewife population, which of course is the food for salmon, declined to the point where they're almost extinct in Lake Huron. And as a result of that, the alewife eat the larvae of any fish, any of our native species that have pelagic larvae. And by that I mean planktonic floating in the top. And alewife go along and they filter the water and they'll eat the larval form. So we saw a big change in a number of species, and one of those is emerald shiners. So if you go to Lake Huron and in the water, there are tremendous numbers of emerald shiners in the water now. And that was the first species that declined when alewife first came in. The alewife are out, and now we're seeing a return of not only emerald shiners, but other species that had pelagic larvae, like walleyes in Saginaw Bay, spectacular increase. Lake trout are doing a lot better because of that, and lake herring, which is a kind of an endangered species in Lake Huron. Those fish are also doing a lot better because of the decline in alewife.
What a lesson in cause and effect.
Yeah, it's really dramatic. So that would be a couple of the species you would run into. I would imagine you might run into a few round gobies there, and you might run into a few rainbow smelt, although they're fairly rare in that area as well. So that would be kind of what you'd find in the nearshore zone if you were out there wading.
Let's not overlook poor old Lake Ontario. We tend to not think of Lake Ontario as much as we do some of the others.
Yeah. Well, Lake Ontario is different, of course, than all four of the other ones because it has access to the ocean. And as a result of that, early on they had Atlantic salmon, and which was unique to the Great Lakes, and the sea lamprey got in there early on because they came in from the ocean. So the species complex in Lake Ontario is a lot different, and it's also very productive. It's similar to Lake Erie, and so you would find species probably similar to what we saw in Lake Erie, but not quite as much. Probably you would get round gobies, you would get gizzard shad, probably spot-tail shiners, and also a number of others, maybe yellow perch. And also there's another bass called the – and it's not a true bass – It's called the white perch, and it's an exotic species as well. And so you probably would run into a bunch of those as well if you were in the nearshore zone in Lake Ontario.
And for so many people in Michigan, summer in Michigan means the West Coast, West Michigan, and Lake Michigan. So what might we find there?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that. One of the things I do regularly is I monitor what's happening in the nearshore zone because we're very concerned about what the Young of the Year alewife are doing and also what the yellow perch are doing. Mm-hmm. And you probably heard that the yellow perch population has been in trouble in Lake Michigan since the quagga and zebra mussels came in for the same reasons I mentioned to you.
That they were in trouble in Huron.
They eat the larvae of the yellow perch, so their populations are reduced. And they also provide a bottleneck for early produced Young of the Year larval forms because they are relying on zooplankton. And zooplankton eat algae. And now that the algae is down, the zooplankton populations are down, which is one of the main foods for yellow perch. So when I do my seining, I'm looking for what the size of the yellow perch is in late August. You know, how are they growing? Did they do well this year? And the number, abundance. So I do a standard kind of tow. And so then I can look over time and see how those numbers have changed. And it's really dramatically low considering I used to get maybe 100 Young of the Year yellow perch in some of my seine hauls. And I got in 6 seine hauls last year, I got 2 yellow perch. And not only were they not very abundant, but they're very small. So that means that they're probably not going to even survive. So the population of Lake Michigan is really being stressed by yellow perch. So if you were a swimmer at South Haven and were in the area that I was seining, we would get—
When you say seining, what does that mean?
Oh, that's dragging a net along the bottom. You know, if you took a volleyball net and made the mesh real small and then pulled it along the shoreline.
See what you can scoop up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, scooping up fish. So if you were there and saw the catch that we made last year, you would see spot-tail shiners again, fairly common. You would see maybe a couple round gobies because they're all along the shoreline now. And we got a few yellow perch, those real scrawny ones. And we got a fairly large number of alewives. And these were all Young of the Year alewives. And again, compared to what, you know, usually we see alewives are about an inch, maybe an inch and a half long by the end of the year. And they spawn early in June and July, depending upon the temperatures and, you know, the duration of spawning. And then at the end of the year when I seine them, usually they're in that range. And if they don't make a certain size, and the same thing is true with the yellow perch, they will die over winter because they have to go out there with all the fat reserves they generate in the growing season. And a lot of these alewives that I was getting were very small. Maybe they were hatched in late July and maybe even early August. And as a result of that, I suspect that a lot of those alewives are dying too. And as I indicated, the population of alewives in Lake Huron is essentially extinct. And Lake Michigan is actually following in that pathway. The populations of alewife, according to USGS trawls, are lower or equal to the lowest levels in 1973 when they first started monitoring for alewives in Lake Michigan. So Lake Michigan is in a kind of a precarious position now. At some point, we might see a decline in the alewives. We might see a rebound, but I suspect decline is what we're going to see. And as a result of that, we might see the same sort of pattern we saw in Lake Huron, in that we might see the salmon population decline as well.
Finally, Superior. Hardy fish up there in Superior.
Well, it's interesting. I like to look for agates. And so I've been up in Lake Superior a few times, wading around in the water, in the cold water. And I found a lake herring, which is one of the species that's in Lake Superior, to the call of loons in the background, I might add, which was very aesthetically pleasing. And I also saw 2 other species, and I I think one was a long-nosed dace, which is a minnow-like species that lives in rocks. And, of course, I was out in the rocks, and so they tend to live in the crevices in the rocks. And I've seen them also in places on the Leelanau Peninsula. For example, Peterson Park, there's a real rocky area there, and I've seen long-nosed dace there as well. And I think the other species I saw was emerald shiners in Lake Superior. So, again, very sparse number of species, and they were very rare. I mean, I spent a lot of time on the shoreline, and I rarely see fish there. But, again, I didn't sample it with any nets,
right.
So I suspect if I did that, I would have gotten more.
What are your biggest concerns for underwater life in all of the Great Lakes? We certainly hear a lot of headlines about Asian carp.
Well, a couple of things I guess I'm concerned about. Invasive species is obviously the number one problem we've seen. The quagga mussel, as I indicated, has just had a dramatic impact on at least four of the Great Lakes. They're, you know, they're not in Lake Superior or not very abundant in Lake Superior because the calcium levels are so low. And I read a paper that suggested that the benthos, which are the bottom-dwelling organisms in Lake Michigan of which quagga mussels are a part, 90% of the benthos now is quagga mussels, 90%. So we're seeing these impacts I mentioned to you. You know, I always like to think about a terrestrial ecosystem. We've got the sun, the grass, the cows, and then we go to McDonald's. Well, in a Great Lakes, we've got what I call aquatic cows. And the aquatic cows that eat the algae are two groups, and that's the zooplankton, which I mentioned to you mm-hmm. are important for early life history of fish. And the other ones are called diaparia, and these are little bottom-dwelling benthic organisms, and they go around the bottom and sweep up the algae that drifts to the bottom. Both of these groups are critical food for fish. You name a fish, and I'll tell you what size eats either zooplankton or diaparia. Now we've seen a tremendous decline in zooplankton. They've gone down maybe to 20% of what they were, and the diaparia have gone from 10,000 per square meter to 5 or 6 or 0 per square meter. And so the fish have had to adjust to this, and as a result, we saw this big change. So invasive species would seem to me right now to be the, you know, one dramatic impact that's going on in at least three of the Great Lakes, Ontario, Michigan, and Huron. And, of course, Erie has been affected, but it's very productive, so we haven't seen the dramatic changes there that we saw in the other Great Lakes.
Fascinating as we think about what's teeming there under the water. David Jude is a research scientist emeritus at the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment. Thanks for the insights. We will be looking at our lakes with fresh eyes.
Fish on!
And an update for you on a story we brought you earlier on Stateside about the water emergency in Bay City. Officials now say they believe they've located the broken water main that was on a property east of the city's wastewater treatment plant, a ruptured 36-inch water main. They'll be turning off the water to that, the valve to that main, and hope that they have solved that water emergency in Bay City. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.